This is Tony and Chelsea Northrup.
And you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James.
Sounds like a character from one of those caper movies, right? Sharky James. All He's right. in charge of explosives.
Now we'll do the first part.
Welcome to the Petapixel Photography Podcast, episode 32. Where is your gear most likely to be stolen? In this episode, LensTag releases interesting gear theft stats. A photographer's lens hood is mistaken for a hockey puck. We have a cool OS 10 hack. The FAA will make drone registry user info public. And listener Alon in Israel seeks advice on which kind of studio backdrop to use. All that and more in episode 32 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Thank you so much, Tony and Chelsea, for opening the show. I'm dying over here. Seriously, that was an awesome intro. And the other outtakes are hilarious too, so I'm going to be putting those at the very end of this episode for everyone to hear because they were so, so funny. I shouldn't be the only one who gets to enjoy them, right? The Northrups have a great YouTube channel. I want you guys all to check it out. And they also have the number one photography book on Amazon.com, so make sure you guys check those out. The easiest way to find the Northrups is by heading over to northrup.photo. That's NORTHRUP.photo. And I'd like to thank you all for joining us here in episode 32 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. We appreciate you guys all so much, and thank you for subscribing, rating, and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever else you listen to us. Okay, with that, I'm your host, Sharky James. Let's hit it. Anti-theft gear registry LensTag has provided us with a look at how camera gear was stolen over this past year, and the numbers might actually surprise you. By a healthy margin, the number one way gear was stolen in 2015 was from automobiles, with 31% of thefts occurring that way. You gotta think that most of those were cameras left in plain sight, right? I mean, they're doing a smash and grab there. They see your camera on your front seat, they're breaking that window, and they are gone before you even know it. That gear was begging to find a new owner, and quick, huh? Hiding your gear in your car does nothing once a thief is actually inside your car, of course. That's why I always recommend something that I've done for years, and that's using anti-theft mesh around your camera bag, such as those available from PackSafe. You then lock that to something metal with a cable, and that slows someone way, way down. And that's not an ad, by the way. I just really appreciate the solutions that they've come up with for things. I have the older ones that are meant to go around backpacks, but they've got newer ones I see that have a tighter mesh pattern designed to keep a lens from slipping through it. You know, a thief isn't expecting to encounter an anti-theft mesh around your gear, and he isn't likely to have tools on him that can actually cut through it. So as long as your car isn't totally hidden from view, that's probably going to be enough to stop them or at least slow them down enough for someone to come by and see what's going on. Now, following theft from vehicles is home burglary, of course, and that comes in at 20%. In your home, a safe or a really, really good hiding spot is going to help guard against theft there. What you do beyond that, you know, a security system, a guard dog, that's all going to help. But you at least have to hide your gear or put it in a safe. Otherwise, someone breaks into your house, that stuff's gone. Now, public transportation comes in at 10%. So I'm guessing that people are on buses or trains or the subway or whatever. They get distracted. They're not watching their gear. Someone makes off with it. That can't exactly happen on a plane so much because you're kind of all locked in a tube up in the air. Now, personal robbery follows at 8%. So that's someone with a knife, a gun, or maybe a metal pipe. I don't know how they're separating you from your gear these days, but that's not so pleasant. 8% of the people right there are getting robbed. Not cool. The rest of the pie chart is gear being lost, who knows where. You know, aside from that, people are leaving it at events, the airport, or an airplane. Like I said, airplane, not so much, probably the airport. Bars and restaurants, postal theft, and in last place at 3% is hotels. LensTag founder Trevor Serrer tells us, quote, "Cars were an even worse place to keep your gear in 2015 versus 2014. Rental cars seem to be consistently targeted," end quote. He says that in terms of where gear is stolen the most, a strong number one is Rome, Italy, with London, England being a distant number two, then Melbourne, Australia. So if you live in any of those cities or you're vacationing there, keep an eye on your gear because they're more likely to walk off in those places than anywhere else. Now, in case you're wondering what camera leads the list of the most stolen, that's the Canon 5D Mark III. Not at all a cheap camera. But back in 2013, though, it was a Nikon D7000, a more consumer-grade body, so that's interesting. Insurance, of course, is a good idea, but often you only get the used condition replacement value. So you might have had only 1,000 actuations on the shutter of your, let's say, Canon 5D Mark III, and you end up getting one that has 100,000. Who knows? So it's really hit or miss there. If you want full replacement value and want to make sure that all your stuff is covered, there's a lot of options out there, but you're going to want to look at what's called an inland marine policy. That's going to have you hooked up. Also, if you're doing photography for a living, it's unlikely that your homeowner's policy is going to cover stolen gear, so make sure to check your policy. A lot of agents will tell you, oh yeah, that's covered, and it turns out it's not. There's a few companies out there like Hill & Usher that offer these kind of policies, and I believe also through the PPA, that's the Professional Photographers of America, you can get this kind of insurance as well. They're not really crazy expensive. We're talking maybe $500, $600 or so a year on average. But if you're worried about having your gear stolen, it would be wise to do what you can to protect it before it's too late. No one ever thinks it's going to happen to them. And can you really afford to lose thousands of dollars worth of gear, especially if you're making your living with that gear? If you want to help protect your camera gear for free, head on over to LensTag.com. It's not going to cost you anything, and you could be doing your part towards trying to protect your gear. If you've been looking for an easy way to remove stubble in Photoshop, thanks to UK glamour photographer Mark P, now we know the trick. You basically select the area, set feather to a suitable number, and that's going to be the hardest part here, but not too bad. Then you choose filter, noise, dust and scratches, and with a correct radius and threshold setting, the stubble should disappear and the skin texture should hold up. That's something that's often lost when fixing blemishes, is it looks like you fixed an area. You want that skin texture. You want them to look human, not plastic like a mannequin, right? Now, it might take a little tinkering with the settings, but it'll save you much more time than doing it the old way, that's for sure. One thing you don't want to have happen when you're shooting an event is to become the center of attention, especially when the game is on the line and you're causing players and fans to get mad at you. That is not good. Such was the case when a photographer shooting the Ontario Reign of the American Hockey League accidentally dropped his lens hood through the small cutout in the glass that he was shooting through. Some of the players saw that black plastic lens hood on the ice and thought it was a puck, but it was not. Now, realizing what was going on, the refs quickly blew their whistles, and the lens hood was returned through the hole to the red-faced photographer, and yeah, that was an uncomfortable moment for him. Hey, it happens. You know, there's a good reason to use a lens hood at a hockey game, especially if you're shooting through the glass and triggering strobes overhead like he was. That lens hood is going to reduce the chance of flare from those overhead lights and also from the ice below. It definitely helps a little bit with knocking down the lack of contrast that you get when all that crazy stuff happens. But I don't know if he's going to be using it from now on. I suspect that if he does, he's going to be gaffer taping that sucker to his lens. Back when I was a working photojournalist, I learned that lesson the hard way. And let me tell you, you don't want to be the focus of everyone's attention and jeers. You want to get in there, get your shots, blend in, and get out of there without anyone noticing you. The lesson here is try to reduce the chances of these things happening to the extent you can. And you know what? It doesn't even matter if you're shooting a hockey game or you're shooting a wedding or whatever. Make sure that your gear is not going to come apart while you're shooting and then all the attention is on you. So to the extent you can, if you can just pre-flight your gear, make sure everything is secured, tape it down with gaffer tape, that would do wonders. Gaffer tape should be in everyone's bag. Everyone's. You'll notice many photojournalists with pieces of that awesome fabric tape on their lens hood, flashes, and even lenses. If you need a quick piece, there it is. If you need more, it's in your bag. Done. If you're an Apple user who's tired of OS X launching Apple Photos every darn time you connect a device or insert a memory card, there's a solution for you thanks to Melbourne, Australia-based photographer Ben Fawn. And all it takes is a single line of code. For the exact text to copy and paste into the terminal program on your Mac, Hit the show notes for episode 32 at petapixel.com/podcast. You know, this solved the problem I was having, but I was too lazy to look it up on Google. And now we all have a solution for it. What happens when you toss hot water into the air when it's minus 40 degrees Celsius out? Well, it freezes pretty much instantly. That's cold. Now, you're not going to see me out in that weather. I love photography, of course, but I have my limits. If it's negative anything, you will find me inside where it's nice and warm. I don't care. I don't like being cold, you know, and my camera shall appreciate that as well. There's only so much your camera can put up with. And I tell you, it told me zero. That's its limit. But braver/crazier than me is Michael Davies of Pangnirtung. That's in Canada's high Arctic. You know, I was lost here at Canada. I live in Idaho now, and Canada is right above us. It's freezing there. Imagine how cold it is there right now. I don't know where you are, but it's probably warmer than minus 40 degrees Celsius. Are you out shooting right now? No. And there's a good reason. It's cold outside. But Davies is used to it, and along with his friend Marcus, they drove 45 minutes on a snowmobile. That's right, not even in a warm car. A snowmobile out in the elements. These are brave guys. They drove to the top of a nearby mountain where he says the light is, quote, almost always pink near the solstice, end quote. And you know what? It was worth it. The resulting images of the hot tea being ejected from a thermos backlit by the sun are quite stunning. And there's a reason why you don't see much of this. That's right, because it is cold outside. Now, I can't show you here on the podcast, of course, so you're going to have to hit the show notes for this episode and check it out. It is quite stunning. And you know, after all the trouble he went through bearing the elements, I think it's worth viewing. And I'm enjoying it from my nice, warm office. So there's that. Today's listener question comes from Alon in Israel, who recorded his question via our voicemail widget at petapixel.com/podcast. Thank you so much for your question, Alon. I greatly appreciate it. You know, we've got many listeners in Israel, and that is awesome. It blows my mind that we have listeners all over this planet. And also, thanks for the compliment. I'm happy you enjoy the podcast. Now, deciding which backdrop to use depends on a number of factors. And this isn't going to be comprehensive, of course. Everyone has their different reasons for why they choose something over another. But don't you just love that? The answer to pretty much every question in photography is, it depends. I think for many, the first consideration is going to be cost. If you're shooting a lot, you're going to have ongoing costs when it comes to paper. They're relatively cheap, but you'll find that you're going to be buying them over and over again. But if you want to have multiple backdrops available and you don't want to spend a fortune, paper is the way to go. It's the cheapest entry point to versatility. Now, fabric, also known as muslin, and also vinyl backdrops are going to be more expensive up front because they cost way more to produce. And muslin especially requires cleaning as it gets dirty. Vinyl, you can kind of mostly wipe off. If something gets spilled on your muslin background or if it rips, you're kind of out of luck for the moment. That, or you're going to have to shoot around that or do more work in post-processing. But with paper, though, you just rip it off, unroll some more, and keep on shooting. Until your roll runs out, of course. So your ability to keep on shooting with paper is higher as long as you have enough supply. They're also easier to light and shoot, in my opinion. They're not as reflective, so you don't have to worry about that. Same with muslin, of course. And with vinyl, that could be an issue depending on how you place your lights. Also, wrinkles are going to be a problem with paper and muslin backgrounds, but not with vinyl. But you can reduce the appearance of wrinkles by making sure that you're not lighting the paper or muslin backdrops from the side, because that reveals texture, of course. You probably want to light your backdrops at a 45-degree angle or so and flag off that light so it doesn't hit your model, and you're good to go. Now, for portability, it's muslin all the way. Fold it up, toss it in a bag, or whatever. It's highly portable. Now, with paper and vinyl, you've got big, cumbersome rolls to deal with. They're hard to transport. They're also unwieldy and awkward, kind of like me. With those, you'll want to stand. With muslin, however, you can throw it over something. You can have a couple friends hold it, and it's not going to get too heavy for them. Their arms might get a little tired, though. You can clip it to whatever. It is definitely way more versatile. Now, if you're just getting into studio photography and you want more options, I think paper is what I would choose. White for sure, and then maybe black or whichever solid color that you think you'd like to use most. I think you're going to find that the versatility of using a paper backdrop is going to make you a lot happier than if you spent way more on a muslin backdrop or vinyl and only had that to shoot on. But if you have a decent budget, by all means, get some of both, and you're going to quickly learn what you prefer, and then from then on, you'll know which one to buy. But things can get really expensive really fast between a stand, some rolls of seamless paper, and even one muslin backdrop. So definitely look into your options and see what your budget will hold. But I would start out with paper for sure. Thank you so much for your question, Alon. I hope that helps. And I'd be interested in knowing what you choose. So if you don't mind, drop me a message, please. Here's a story I've been meaning to cover, but now it's time. In Lebanon, apparently it's legal to marry 14-year-olds without their parents' permission, and marrying 12-year-olds there isn't rare. Now, I want to say right off the bat that this isn't all of the Lebanese people, of course, and most, I'm sure, don't condone this. It's a remnant of cultural norms from a long time ago, and their legal system apparently hasn't caught up. And you know what? Here in America, we can't exactly point fingers. You know, I'm talking about slavery, so we're not perfect as well. But it's nearly 2016 now, and marrying children needs to stop, of course. And that was the point of a social experiment conducted by the rights organization CAFA recently. The Lebanese-based organization used photography to help effect change. And like I always say, photography is powerful, as we all know. They set up a mock wedding photo shoot between an older man and a 12-year-old dressed as if they were just married, and hidden cameras caught the reactions of passersby who were shocked and outraged by what they were witnessing. Amazingly, though, some people actually congratulated the mock wedding couple, but the vast majority of people were really upset by what they saw. 12, of course, is just too young to be getting married, and especially to an older man. Not just a much older man. And yes, that's judgmental, and yes, this isn't my culture, but hey, wrong is wrong, right? Now, according to UNICEF, there are over 700 million women alive today that were married as children, and 250 million of them having been married before the age of 15. Let that sink in for a while. Almost a billion women on planet Earth right now, and there's 7+ billion people on Earth, were married when they were children. Wow. They write, quote, "While data from 47 countries shows that overall the median age of first marriage is gradually increasing, this improvement has been limited primarily to girls of families with higher incomes. But without far more intensive and sustained action now from all parts of society, hundreds of millions more girls will suffer profound, permanent, and utterly unnecessary harm." End quote. Now, I love how they used a mock photo shoot to draw attention to this issue. That was pretty cool. So many people tell me they feel like they have no direction with their photography and that they're not inspired. And while it might be hard to find issues like this to champion with your photography, there's still a lot that you can do. Hey, even if it's volunteering your services to photograph animals for your local shelter to help them find homes, you can make a difference with your photography. And along the way, it'll also improve your skills, of course. So I challenge everyone who's feeling uninspired to search out a project or cause that they can volunteer their skills to. It doesn't have to be an animal shelter. It could be a social cause or a political campaign, anything. Give your photography purpose and help make a difference. It's one of those things I liked best about being a photojournalist. Sure, I was being paid and sure it was a lot of fun and rewarding, but there were times where my photographs told a story that had real impact and changed lives for the better. And that was really, really cool. You know, it's 2 days before Christmas as I record this, and so many people are homeless or hungry or otherwise not having an easy time in their lives. We are so blessed to enjoy photography, the gear associated with it, and sometimes I think we forget that. I know I do. So stories like this remind me that photography just isn't about pretty images. Sometimes what's on the other side of the camera may be hard to look at, but you can document it and affect change, and that is pretty powerful. So if you have a way to give back using your skills, consider doing so. It can really change lives. In episode 31, we told you how Kodak amazingly still has over 700 people still working in its film division. I was surprised by that. I would have guessed much, much lower. Like maybe seven. Okay, maybe not that low. Well, this past Sunday, December 20th, 2015, on 60 Minutes, in a story about Apple, it was revealed that the ginormous company has over 800 people dedicated just to the camera in the iPhone. Now, that is truly amazing. That is a lot of people working on one little component, but a very important component. You know, it's really not surprising when you consider that the camera is the most used feature of the iPhone, or pretty much any smartphone these days, especially if you're a teenager. Also, in the last episode of this podcast, we reported on how Apple's iPhone absolutely dominates Flickr's top cameras in 2015. That, too, is also not a surprise. The head of Apple's camera division, Graham Townsend, told 60 Minutes' Charlie Rose that there are 200 separate components in each tiny iPhone camera module, including the four wires which hold the suspension system used to stabilize the camera from shaky hands. Now, those wires, amazingly, are just 40 microns in width. That's less than half that of a human hair. Those are tiny. How do they even find those darn things? I'm losing screws that are many, many times thicker than a human hair. Apple, I tell you, they're on top of things. Their camera testing lab simulates all kinds of lighting from extremely bright noon sunlight to simulated sunset and everything in between. And as cool as that is, even more amazing is the fact that every time you capture a photo with an iPhone, there are 24 billion operations that happen. 24 billion. I think that 22 would have been plenty, don't you? Maybe not. Those extra two make all the difference, I'm sure. Seriously, the good old days of camera drone ownership in the United States are gone. As we reported in episode 30 of this podcast, details of the Federal Drone Registry have been released, and now we have confirmation that everyone's names and addresses will be publicly available. Now, why is that a problem, you may ask? Well, maybe you don't want everyone knowing that you have an expensive drone in your house. You know, maybe that means you have other fancy gear as well. Personally, I don't think this is as big of a deal as some are making it out to be. Everyone has valuables in their home, right? So unless a thief is looking specifically to steal a drone, you're probably okay. Now, of course, a thief who's on top of things just needs to go to a public park or wherever else they're likely to find drones, use a pair of binoculars, a lens, or whatever, record the registration number for that drone, enter it into the database online, and then they have your home address. The thief doesn't even need to follow you home anymore. So that's going to be a little bit worrisome for some people. Now, if you own a drone, I would revisit your home security plan ASAP. Maybe get one of those Ring doorbells. That's also not an ad, by the way. It's just a great product. If you can afford it and you value your gear, especially if you don't have insurance, it's a great way of thwarting a lot of theft. Someone comes to your door, rings your doorbell, you get an alert on your phone, and you can talk to them. It makes it seem like you're at home, but you just don't want to come to the door. According to the experts, most break-ins happen during the day while people are at work, and thieves will often ring the doorbell to see if anyone's home. If someone answers, they're not likely to hit your house. But if no one answers, they know that chances are no one's home, they're coming in. That's why they showed up at your house in the first place, and especially if they visited the drone registry online and know you've got a drone inside. Now, imagine if there was a list somewhere online of Nikon and Canon owners. Yeah, that's a bit unsettling. The public nature of the drone registry was recently confirmed by Forbes reporter John Goglia, and the FAA told him, quote, "Until the drone registry system is modified, the FAA will not release names and addresses. When the drone registry system is modified to permit searches of registration numbers, names and addresses will be revealed through those searches," end quote. He learned that email addresses, however, and of course credit card information will be kept private, but the rest will be in the public domain. And I think a lot of people were not prepared for that. The FAA also told the reporter, quote, "Initially, the registration system will not have a public search function. The FAA plans to incorporate a search by registration number in the future. Names and addresses are protected by the Privacy Act. The FAA will handle the disclosure of such information in accordance with the December 15, 2015 Federal Register Notice," end quote. So the public would need an actual registration number to come up with the name and address, but like I said, that's going to be visible on your drone when you're flying around or takeoff and landing or whatever. They want the public to be able to write that information down, if you can see it. Who knows how big these stickers are going to be that they're going to be sending out to people to put on their drones, but I don't know, I guess everyone's going to have a pair of binoculars just so they can see the numbers now. Good luck with that, right? And it'll be interesting to see if those registration numbers are going to be sequential or not. Because if you could just plug in a number and just advance it by one and come up with results, that's not good. Now, on December 17, 2015, the Academy of Model Aeronautics announced that it'll be looking into means of putting a stop to the drone registry altogether. They're even advising its members to hold off on registering their drones, but that would also mean not flying them. Because if you're going to fly them, you must register your drone. So we'll see what comes of this, and of course we'll let you know when and if things change. But in the meantime, if you're getting a drone soon or you have one now, you have to register it here in the United States and be prepared for the public to have a method of getting your name and address, at least if they have your drone's registration number. So, you know, pretty much wherever you fly it. Now, don't forget to stay tuned to the very end of this episode following the music for the rest of Tony and Chelsea Northrup's funny, funny intro takes. They are hilarious. I'd like to thank you all for listening to episode 32 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Don't forget to check us out at petapixel.com/podcast for the show notes and to see what else we have for you. If you head on over there, you can leave us a voicemail question that we can answer here on the show. And if you don't feel comfortable leaving a voicemail, feel free to email me at lensshark@gmail.com. And if you'd like to connect with me personally, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook where I'm Lensshark. That's LENSSHARK. All right, with that, I'll see you all in episode 33. Well, it's f8 and 250th of a second outside. It's time to shoot.
Please subscribe to the Petapixel Photography Podcast. My daddy is the host.
This is Chelsea and Tony Northrup.
I'll try that again.
This is Chelsea and Tony Northrup.
And you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James.
I'm going to do the whole thing. This is Chelsea and Tony Northrup, and you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with
Sharky James. This is Tony and Chelsea Northrup, and you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with
Sharky James.
We've had a lot to drink, Sharky.
Let's do it together like creepy twins.
Okay. This is Tony and Chelsea Northrup.
And you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James.
No wonder you...
That was not creepy twins.
No. No wonder you're not a real creepy twin.
Okay, ready? We'll be like, this is Tony and Chelsea.
Okay.
This is Tony and Chelsea Northrup, and you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James. Justin, you lost your when that meat came on the screen.
Like people didn't know you or something. Yeah, that'd just be so weird.
How about I'll do the low voice and you do the high voice?
Okay.
Hi. Hi.
This is Tony.
No, well, I'll do the first half and you do the second half.
Oh, okay.
Hey, this is Tony and Chelsea Northrup.
And you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James. I feel like that one's a winner.
All right, let's just do normal. This is probably what he wanted.
Yeah.
This is Tony and Chelsea Northrup.
And you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James.
Now you do the beginning.
This is Tony and Chelsea Northrup.
And you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James. We got it! Oh!
Do we get to go on the Petapixel Photography Podcast, or do we just record the intro?
Oh, let's do another one where we ask.
That was me asking, but...
Well, we have to send it to Sharky James.
Right, okay.
Ready?
We're still rolling.
This is Chelsea and Tony Northrup, and we're wondering when we get to go on the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James.
Me too.
Me too. That's it. I need to eat.
Thanks, Sharky.
Thanks, Sharky.